Numbers. Prayerfully, we're going to take chapters 30 and 31 tonight. In the book of Numbers, tonight chapters 30 and 31. We're in this section where God commanded the children of Israel to be numbered. That would be for the purpose of entering into the promised land, that there would be land appointed to them and apportioned to them, and it would be according to the size of their tribes. So they were numbered for that reason, plus the fact of war also. Those 20 years old and older were eligible for war, and they needed to know how many were eligible for war. Also, last week we saw that the offerings were commanded by the Lord as part of their worship. The appointed feasts throughout on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, and yearly basis. They were to come and make their offerings to the Lord as a point of worship. The connection with chapter 30, in case you read over it before tonight, chapter 30 has to do with the making of vows and taking of oaths. And this in connection with worship is because usually the vow or the oath was made at the time of bringing one's sacrifice to the tabernacle area. And so in connection with the offerings and these sacrifices at the various feast days in chapter 29 and chapter 30 now, we move into vows, but it is the vows. If you look at the last verse of chapter 30, it tells us, verse 16, these are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses between a man and his wife and between a father and his daughter in her youth in her father's house. It all has to do with the legality, the responsibility of a woman or girl when she takes an oath or makes a commitment or takes a vow. Just exactly how responsible is she to keep that vow? Just in summary, basically, if she lives in her father's house and she makes a vow and her father hears it and he remains silent, then the vow is intact and she must keep her vow. If he hears the vow and he objects to it and cancels it out, then she does not have to keep the vow. As the head of the house, he can either accept it by remaining silent or object to it and cancel out the responsibility for the vow. If a woman is married, she leaves her father's house and is now with a husband, the husband holds the same responsibilities. If he hears his wife make a vow or take an oath and he remains silent, then she must keep her vow. But if he objects to it and overrules it, then she does not keep the vow. Protection from impulsive reaction, making vows and taking oaths, and also the placement of the responsibility upon the head of the household, whether it be the father or whether it be the husband. He enacts responsibility. What I find interesting about this is the basic principle of keeping silent or speaking up. How many times we're in a situation as heads of our household, if we are heads of our household, and if you're not a head of a household, someday you will be, but how many times we keep silent when as the head of the household we are to take responsibility. Keeping silent, according to the Lord, when one knows the truth, keeping silent is approval. And speaking up for the household is taking one's position before the Lord. The responsibility is given to the man, the father, before the Lord. And also that taking a vow, making a vow or making an oath, a vow basically is a commitment that one makes to the Lord. That is a vow. An oath is a pledge that one makes to another human being. It's like a contract. It is a promise. What I find interesting here is that those people in positions of responsibility, if they are to approve of the vow or the oath that is taken, it is binding. how serious it is, and how serious the Lord takes it, when we make a commitment to Christ. When we say, Lord, I'm going to follow you no matter what. That's binding. That is binding. And the Lord's going to hold us to it. It goes along with the principle that Jesus said in the Gospels, recorded in the Gospels. Also brought out by Paul and Peter in various ways. But the same principle is true. That if a person hears the truth and then does not do it, been better for him he had not even been born. Been better for him he had not even heard the truth than to hear the truth and reject it or not do it. There's a basic principle about commitments to Christ, about responding to truth. The more we hear the truth and the more we make our decisions for Christ, the more responsible he holds us for. To the point that if we ever back off on our commitment to Christ and back off from doing the truth, a lot of times it appears, because it probably is true, that a non-believer has a better state of mind than the believer who knows the truth and doesn't do it. The believer is the one that's miserable. So chapter 30 says, Then Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes concerning the children of Israel, saying, This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. If a man makes a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by some agreement, he shall not break his word. Period. There are certain circumstances when people are not responsible, and that's what he's going to deal with. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Everything. Or if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by some agreement while in her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow and the agreement by which she has bound herself, and her father holds his peace, then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement with which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father overrules her on the day that he hears it, then none of her vows nor her agreements by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will release her because her father overruled her. So it's the Lord who releases her. It isn't man. Because God has given the authority and the responsibility to the head of the household. So in verse 2, it tells us about a man if he takes a vow. Whatever the man says, that's it. He's bound. But in verses 3 through 5, a woman under her father's house. The father has, again, the authority of binding and loosing, even over his daughter. But verse 6, if indeed she takes a husband, while bound by her vows or by a rash utterance from her lips by which she bound herself, and her husband hears it and makes no response to her on the day that he hears, then her vows shall stand and her agreements by which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband overrules her on the day that he hears it, he shall make void her vow which she took and what she uttered with her lips by which she bound herself, and the Lord will release her. These are the vows now. We're getting into the areas of under the husband's roof. But in verses 6, 7, and 8, it has to do with making vows prior to being married and then coming in under the house. And they had a little ceremony where the woman would actually recite her vows before entering into the man's house and entering into the covenant agreement of marriage with the man. Now, any vows that she made prior to being married and she recited the vows, the husband had the authority that once they would be married and he would be her husband, he could cancel out any vows that she made. She can't carry those vows into his house if he voids them. Verse 9. And any vow of a widow or a divorced woman by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. So she has no covering. The widowed woman or the divorced woman, whatever vow she makes, it's binding. Now for the marriage situation. Is she vowed in her husband's house or bound herself by an agreement with an oath? You can see the difference between verse 10 and verse 6. She is now in her husband's house. Before, it was making a vow before entering into his house as his wife. Now it's she is her husband's wife, and she, or bound herself by an agreement with an oath, and her husband heard it and made no response to her and did not overrule her, then all her vows shall stand, and every agreement by which she bound herself shall stand. Now, this is one of those laws that you wish that Christians were actually under the law. Just if you were married, you know what I'm saying. Just on those shopping spree instances, you know, you can say, cancel, you know. But this is another instance where actually the husband plays the same role as the father did. He is now the head of the house, and any vow that his wife makes, if he hears the vow or when he hears of it, he can overrule it at any time. And she is not bound, and then she's released. It says here, her husband has made them void at the end of verse 12. Actually, we should read verse 12. But if her husband truly made them void on the day he heard them, then whatever proceeded from her lips concerning her vows or concerning the agreement binding her, it shall not stand. Her husband has made them void, and the Lord will release her. Every vow and every binding oath to afflict her soul. Her husband may confirm it, or her husband may make it void. Sometimes they would take vows that would put their physical life in hardship. Maybe go to some isolated place, go without food, fasting. Some kind of a show of affliction in the soul. Well, the husband has the right to overrule that and say, no, you're not going to do that. Now, if her husband makes no response whatever to her from day to day, then he confirms all her vows or all the agreements that bind her. Interesting, in the Lord's eyes, silence means agreement. Silence means agreement. He confirms them by remaining silent, because he made no response to her on the day that he heard them. But if he does make them void after he has heard them, then he shall bear her guilt. In other words, whatever guilt she has for making the agreement, I mean, it could have caused some kind of hardship. Maybe she acquired some animals. Maybe one died in the meantime and he canceled the debt. Then he has to make it good. If she had to return the animals that she made the deal for, then one's missing, then he's got to make up for it if he cancels the agreement. Everything has to be returned. Everything has to be done with the same condition and manner in which the contract and agreement was made. These are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses between a man and his wife, and between a father and his daughter in her youth in her father's house. So now as we go into chapter 31, we have an interesting situation that has tremendous teaching to it. We're dealing here in verses 1 through 11. Remember, they counted their people to go to war. And you remember that God said, vengeance shall be taken against the Midianites. The Midianite women were the ones who went out under the counsel of Balaam to cause the children of Israel to sin against the Lord. You remember Balaam, Balak, the king of Moab, came to Balaam and said, put a curse on the children of Israel so that we can defeat them. And basically Balaam's response was, the Lord has dealt with me and said, these people are blessed by God. You cannot curse them. Once God has blessed you, no one can reverse that. But what Balaam did was, says, you can't move God against his people. You can't change God. Once God's blessing is pronounced upon his people, you can't change that. But what you can do is get the people to sin against God, because God has to judge sin. Therefore, send the women out to seduce the men and cause God to become angry over their sin, and God will judge them. So you can defeat them that way. So it's a little way of saying, I have to go by the word of the Lord. And by the way, you want to know how to get them defeated? Get them to sin. Yeah. So we'll see that Balaam's going to be dealt with here too. So now God is taking vengeance on the Midianites. And there's a lot of principles, a lot of questions come up, but there's some good insights as to the character of God, whether we agree with it or not from a humanitarianistic standpoint, but there's some interesting lessons. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take vengeance on the Midianites for the children of Israel. Afterwards you shall be gathered to your people." In other words, he's saying to Moses, take vengeance on the Midianites and then you're going to be called home. And that would be it for Moses. This will be his final battle that he will take. And notice, please, that this is not Moses. This is the Lord giving the command to take vengeance on the Midianites. This is the Lord's command. Verse 3, "So Moses spoke to the people, saying, 'Arm some of yourselves for war, and let them go against the Midianites to take vengeance for the Lord on Midian. 1,000 from each tribe of all the tribes of Israel you shall send to the war.' So there were recruited from the divisions of Israel 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. Then Moses sent them to the war, 1,000 from each tribe. He sent them to the war with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, with the holy articles and the signal trumpets in his hand. And they warred against the Midianites, just as the Lord commanded Moses, and they killed all of the males. They killed the kings of Midian with the rest of those who were killed: Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Revah, the five kings of Midian. Balaam, the son of Beor, they also killed with the sword." Balaam was killed in this battle. "And the children of Israel took the women of Midian captive, with their little ones, and took as spoil all their cattle, all their flocks, and all their goods. They also burned with fire all the cities where they dwelt and all their forts. And they took all the spoil and all the booty of man and beast. Then they brought the captives, the booty, and the spoil to Moses, to Eleazar the priest, and to the congregation of the children of Israel, to the camp of the plains in the plains in Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho. And Moses, Eleazar the priest, and all the leaders of the congregation went to meet them outside the camp. But Moses was angry with the officers of the army, with the captains over thousands and captains over hundreds, who had come from the battle. And Moses said to them, 'Have you kept all the women alive?'" See, they killed all the men. They took the women alive. They took the children alive. They took the cattle. They burned the cities. Moses was angry because they didn't kill the women. And right away you're saying, what a bloodthirsty man. He was representing God and God's command to take vengeance on the Midianites. Not some of them, all of them. "Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor. And there was a plague amongst the congregation of the Lord. Now therefore kill every male amongst the little ones, and kill every woman who has known a man intimately. But keep alive for yourselves all the young girls who have not known a man intimately. And as for you, you remain outside the camp for 7 days. Whoever has killed any person, or whoever has touched any slain, purify yourselves and your captives on the third day and on the seventh day. Purify every garment, everything made of leather, everything woven of goat's hair, and everything made of wood." And so this was the command of God, and Moses came out and was angry with them because they spared some people and killed others. And he says the women are responsible. Every woman who has known a man intimately, she is to be killed. A very harsh thing. There are people I have read commentaries on this section that they basically said this incident never happened because God would never allow it to happen, nor would He give any of His leaders authority to make it happen, nor would God ever command it to happen. God isn't like that. He doesn't command such slaughters or what would appear to be slaughters. In fact, these same commentators say that this is just a made-up story to show spiritual principles. But it never happened. It was never a part of history. The kings are mentioned. The actual battle is mentioned. The actual incidents are mentioned. But it never says anything about a story. It actually happened. And it literally, God takes responsibility for it. Hold your place there for a moment, if you would, and turn with me to 1 Samuel. Be to your right a few books. 1 Samuel chapter 15. Another incident that happened later on in the history of Israel, almost the same exact incident. 1 Samuel chapter 15, beginning at verse 1. Samuel also said to Saul, "The Lord has sent me to anoint you king over His people, over Israel. Now therefore heed the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have. And do not spare them." This is the command of the Lord through His prophet. "But kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey." So Saul gathered the people together and numbered them, and Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to a city of Amalek, and lay in wait in the valley. Then Saul said to the Kenites, "Go, depart, get down from amongst the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up out of Egypt." So the Kenites departed from amongst the Amalekites. And Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them. But everything despised and worthless that they utterly destroyed. That's human nature. You know, it's easy to obey the command of the Lord when it's worthless. You know, something's been maimed or lamed. You're almost doing it a service to put it out of its misery or to get rid of it. But they took Agag the king. They took the best of the animals and didn't destroy them. Now the word of the Lord came to Samuel saying, Samuel is the prophet, remember. "I greatly regret that I have set up Saul as king. For he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. And it grieved Samuel, and he cried out to the Lord all night long." The prophet wept because God is going to remove Saul from being king because he did not obey the commandment of the Lord. "So when Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, it was told Samuel, saying, 'Saul went to Carmel. And indeed, he set up a monument for himself. And he has gone on around and passed by and gone down to Gilgal.' Then Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said to him, 'Blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord.' But Samuel said, 'What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?'" In other words, if you've kept the commandment of the God, of God, then what are these animal sounds that I hear? And Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed." So you know what he did? He disobeyed the Lord, but in his disobedience, he dedicated it to God. It just goes to show you the deceptions of human nature and its sin. I'll just commit it to the Lord. In my disobedience to the Lord. I'll be disobedient, but I'll witness for the Lord. I'll be disobedient, but I'll just talk to somebody about the Lord, and it'll be okay. I mean, we get into that fix where we're being disobedient, but we try to salvage something out of it. But Saul, he was sincere. He was going to take the best for the Lord. It was just a great victory. But God doesn't want our best. Look what he says. Then Samuel said to Saul, verse 16, "Be quiet, and I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night." And he said, "Speak on." So Samuel said, "When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed.' Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord?" And Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me. And I brought back Agag, king of Amalek, and I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal." And now he's saying, the people took them. They're under my command, but the people took them, and the people said, "Well, we'll sacrifice the best to the Lord." Sounds good to me. So Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord?" Now, one of the great scriptures and lines in the Bible at the end of verse 22. "Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. And to take heed," that is to respond to his word, "better than the fat of rams." The highest form of worship is obedience. We have a deceptiveness about us, even within our Christianity, that if I dedicate or commit something to the Lord, it makes up for my disobedience, and it doesn't. The Lord wants our hearts. He wants us to be obedient. In fact, the word worship in the New Testament, proskuneo, literally means, it was a phrase used for a subject when he came into the king's presence, and he would bow down and kiss his ring to show homage, to show submission. The word worship actually denotes submission. That's why in John chapter 4, when Jesus said, "God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth." Literally, the Father is worshipped by people who are in submission to his spirit and submission to his truth. That's worship. Highest form of worship. That's why Jesus said, "You honor me with your lips. You praise me with your lips and you honor me with your lips, but your heart is far from me, and in vain you do worship me." So God says, "I want your heart. Anything that comes from your lips or comes from your expression of dedication or commitment, and it's the opposite of the condition of your heart, your heart's response to me, it's not acceptable." Obedience is better than sacrifice. Verse 23, "For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft." We would say witchcraft and sorcery and divination is a pretty serious sin. Equivalent to the phase or stage of demonic activity. Rebellion is equal to witchcraft. "And stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he also has rejected you from being king." And Saul said to Samuel, "I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and I obeyed their voice. Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord. But Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. So it's a tragic story, but there's tremendous teachings here. It's, if you go back to our text now in Numbers, chapter 31, does God command? Has He commanded and did He command for an entire nation to be destroyed? The answer is yes. Women and children? Yes. Infants? I mean babies? Yes, He has. It is God's responsibility. He commanded it. He did it. We shouldn't try to get out around it. And there's a reason for it, and there's a lesson to be learned. The reason is this. If you don't wipe out sin, it'll rise up again and spread. God wanted them entirely wiped out. That's why He told Saul to wipe them out. It's because if you leave the little ones alive after growing up in that environment, someday they're going to grow up. They're innocent now, but someday they're going to grow up and they're going to reform as a nation and they're going to come back at you and sin will rise itself up again.
World War I, too.
Yep. You're right.
John?
You're right. But
concerned about World War III and the same
plan. That's right. So we have a humanitarian response and a religious response. We say, in essence, it's that part of human nature that says, I don't want to hurt anybody. Does that ring a bell? I don't want to hurt anybody. I'd say killing somebody is hurting them. I'd say killing children and infants, that's a lot of hurt. But God commanded it because of sin. Had they been spared, sin would have risen up and come against God's people. Why does God command us such harsh things, especially in the New Testament, especially when it says, be not unequally yoked together, come out from amongst them and be separate? What if it hurts their feelings? What if people get angry? What if people come back and say, how can you do that to me? Because it's necessary. Because if a little bit of sin is left, it'll spread and take over. As sincere as the people might be, it'll take over. It has to be done away. Light and darkness cannot have fellowship together. The influences of, people basically, our major decision making in life is the spirit, making a decision as to what spirit we're going to be influenced by. Either Satan or Christ through the person of the Holy Spirit. And when people make decisions to reject Christ, and the Bible says those people are energized by Satan, they have to take responsibility for that. And if they're hurt because of the punishment for their sin, which is basically the hurt that they feel, they've made the decision to be disobedient to Christ. So the hurt that they experience in separation, and because we cannot fellowship with them, is the consequences for their own sin. And at the same time, the command is given to us because their sin and their influence is going to affect our walk with the Lord. And God says it can't even be there, even 1%. Well, I tell you what, we won't even talk about the things of the Lord. Then everything will be okay. It will not be okay. You can see God's nature. If a nation, a person, a family comes to a point where they're just so filled with sin to the point that they are a detriment to the spiritual welfare of His people, then the approach must be taken, like Paul said in 1 Corinthians 5 about the man who is in sin and refused to repent. He says, you have to remove the sin from your midst. Period. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. And when God looks at a situation of sin When God looks at His people, there's His people and there's everybody else. When God looks at a situation, all of sin and all of the influence of those who are rejecting Christ must be eradicated out of our lives. Now, we have to be in the world. So we're constantly coming in contact with sin, and we're constantly coming in contact with people who are rebellious against Christ. We work with them. We deal with them. We live around them, whatever the case may be. We can't do anything about that. But, or else we'd have to leave the world, like Paul said. So we have a continual need to hear the word and to be cleansed in order to, if anything, just to break even, counteract the influence of sin of the world that's all around us. But to actually be yoked to actually participate with in an intimate way those people who are energized by Satan, even people who are demonically possessed, God says it's forbidden. Separate yourselves. Do not be yoked with those people, because it will have an influence on you. Period. Oh, but I don't want to hurt their feelings. So our human nature, you know, enters into the picture. God would never, in fact, I've had people tell me, God would never tell me to do that. Because He would never cause me to do anything that caused other people to be hurt. That's when I go to these texts and say, God would never do anything to cause people to be hurt. He's commanded His people to go in there and wipe people out. And it's because those people had, and their nation, their people had come to a point that sin was so rampant in them that it was time for judgment, and sin had to be done away with, or else it would affect His people. It had to be done away with. So death was the result of sin. But it was in the hands of God's people. It's interesting, just in this study, just mentioning a few things about it, the difference between obeying the Lord in consideration of how it's going to affect other people. God would never allow tell me to do this. I don't want to get Him mad at me. I don't want to get her mad at me. I don't want to be rejected by them. And so we compromise. God says no. There's no compromise. And you know who gets dealt with if we compromise? Guess who gets hurt? You know? And God comes to us and says, you have not obeyed the word of the Lord. Then He deals with us. It's a very serious thing, but it is an interesting side of God. In case we should ever, our little emotional humanitarianistic thing should ever kick in and say, well, if I obey the Lord, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be upset or hurt or whatever. And God would never, I don't want to hurt them, or God would never make me do that. So therefore, that can't be of the Lord. Yeah? God doesn't look at it that way. If people are hurt because of my obedience to the Lord, they are hurt because they are experiencing the consequences of their own sin. And those consequences are that if they have or are rejecting Christ, I cannot participate with them. Period. And if they're hurt over it, it's because of their rejection of Christ. Not because I'm punishing them or because I'm doing anything to them. That's God's orders. Numbers chapter 31. Verse 21, then Eleazar the priest said to the men of war who had gone to the battle, this is the ordinance of the law which the Lord commanded Moses. Only the gold, the silver, the bronze, the iron, the tin, and the lead, everything that can endure fire, you shall put through the fire, and it shall be clean. And it shall be purified with the water of purification. But all that cannot endure the fire shall be put through the water. So there had to be a cleansing before any of these articles could come back into the camp, just to show you what God thinks of sin, anything that was in their hands. Had to go through ceremonial cleansing, according to the law of God, before it could be even allowed in the camp. And when we buy their lawnmowers at the garage sale, you know, and bring them into our house, you don't think sin is serious. So Some people think nothing can touch a Christian. Are you kidding? Look what God said about His people. All the things that can pass through the fire, burn it. Then wash it with the water of purification. And if something is burnable, then don't put it in the fire, but wash it with the water of purification. It has to be clean before it can come into your camp. Of course, it was all ceremonial. There wasn't anything, there wasn't any kind of demon in it, but it just goes to show you that that which had to be washed and cleansed through Christ is the only thing that can enter into the camp. Everything else would contaminate the camp. And you shall wash your clothes on the seventh day and be clean. And afterwards you may come into the camp. So even through this purification process, they were still unclean for 7 days because they were handling unclean things while they were purifying them. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Count up the plunder that was taken of man and beast, you and Eleazar the priest and the chief fathers of the congregation, and divide the plunder into two parts between those who took part in the war, who went out to battle, and all the congregation." So it's divided 50-50 amongst those who went to war, 12,000 people, and the other 50% of everything went back to the congregation. It tells us the importance of things. The congregation was back, probably continuing the sacrifices and continuing to pray for those men who were in battle, and they received the reward of the battle too. There are no insignificant people. It's not just the people who are up front preaching the word. It's the people who are praying. It's the people who are participating, even though physically they are not present. The reward of the fruit of the battle goes to everybody. "And levy a tribute for the Lord on the men of war who went out to battle. One of every 500 of the persons, the cattle, the donkeys, and the sheep." So one out of every 500 goes to the Lord. "Take it from their half and give it to Eleazar the priest as a heave offering to the Lord. And from the children of Israel's half you shall take one of every 50, drawn from the persons, the cattle, the donkeys, the sheep, from all the livestock, and give them to the Levites who keep charge of the tabernacle of the Lord." So Moses and Eleazar the priest did as the Lord commanded Moses. The booty remaining from the plunder which the men of war had taken was 675,000 sheep. That's a lot of animals. We're not talking about a little herd of sheep here. 72,000 cattle, 61,000 donkeys, and 32,000 persons in all, of women who had not known a man intimately. And the half, the portion for those who had gone out to war, was a number 337,500 sheep. And the Lord's tribute of the sheep was 675. The cattle were 36,000, of which the Lord's tribute was 72. The donkeys were 30,500, of which the Lord's tribute was 61. The persons were 16,000, of which the Lord's tribute was 32 persons.
What did the Lord do with those persons?
Well, they were given to the priests. I would imagine they would serve as servitude to the priests. So Moses gave the tribute, which was the Lord's heave offering, to Eleazar the priest, as the Lord commanded Moses. And interesting, in all of these things, the Lord is to be remembered. He is to get a portion of all the increase. It is God's way. His command is God's way of causing man to stop and recognize that all of his increase, no matter what, is given by the hand of the Lord. Verse 42, "And from the children of Israel's half, which Moses separated from the men who fought." Now the half belonging to the congregation was 337,500 sheep, 36,000 cattle, 30,500 donkeys, and 16,000 people. "And from the children of Israel's half, Moses took one of every 50, drawn from man and beast, and gave them to the Levites." Interesting, the Levites who served in the temple, who kept charge of the tabernacle of the Lord, as the Lord commanded Moses, they got one out of every 50 for them. "Then the officers, who were over thousands of the army, the captains of thousands and captains of hundreds, came near to Moses, and they said to Moses, 'Your servants have taken account of the men of war who are under our command. And not a man of us is missing. Can you imagine? With the entire battle, not one Israeli soldier was killed. Everybody's accounted for. Therefore we have brought an offering for the Lord. What every man found of ornaments of gold, armlets and bracelets and signet rings and earrings and necklaces to make atonement for ourselves before the Lord. So Moses and Eleazar the priest received the gold from them, all the fashioned ornaments, and all the gold of the offering that they offered to the Lord from the captains of thousands and captains of hundreds was 16,750 shekels. The men of war had taken spoil, every man for himself. So what this is saying is, the men of war were so thankful of the Lord's care over them that they offered from their own personal rewards for their war, they offered from their own personal rewards all these things to give it to the Lord to say thank you. And Moses and Eleazar the priest received the gold from the captains of thousands and of hundreds and brought it into the tabernacle of meeting as a memorial for the children of Israel before the Lord. The Lord is remembered in everything. How we begrudge Him when He asks us to give. And yet if we don't, how He deals with us. Because if we don't give, it's not a matter of legalism. It's a matter of that's what our heart's like. Because a heart's response is to show the Lord thanks by giving back to Him. And when we don't give back to Him, our heart is saying no thanks to the Lord. He deals with us. Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 9 dealt with the fact that the one who sows a blessing reaps a blessing. The one who sows sparingly reaps sparingly. He's talking about the Lord's work. In remembering the Lord, and by giving, it is not a legal obligation. It's actually a response to the Lord. It's by way of saying thanks to Him. It's by way of supporting His work upon the earth. But it's a way of saying thanks. It's a form of worship for all that He is to us and all that He's done for us. Next week, if you want to read ahead, please read chapters 32 and 33 for next week. We'll see how far we get.